So now everybody will come back out and we'll have questions and anything people can tell us about what's going on here with water in this watershed and in your own communities.
In Northampton, there's a big controversy because they want to expand our landfill, and it's right over the East Hampton aquifer.
So what stage is it at? What are people doing? What are the possibilities?
I haven't heard of any positive possibilities. Mm. I think it's just a lot of fear and arguments that I know.
Does it seem like it's bound to happen?
Yes. Mm. I think often we have that attitude that there's nothing we can do about it.
Right. I think those are the things that are, there's a lot of stuff in our book about people who have fought dams and won, and like, what's more monolithic than a dam, you know? So when I hear you talk about that and about how, and I totally feel how like difficult it would be to think about approaching that, I think of one, people who have stopped dams from being building, two, people who have taken dams that have been built and are getting them torn down, and three, an interesting fact that we learned recently that right now in California, they're in Northern California, they're thinking about raising Shasta Dam 20 feet. Between 16 and 200 feet, I apologize, which is huge. And even 16 feet is a multi-million-dollar project. It's across the whole length of the dam. And however high that dam goes, it floods water way back. It destroys more habitat. It's ridiculous. They want to do it. The fact is that to stop that, all they would need is for everyone in California to use a low-flow shower head. Like, which give great pressure. I kind of love them just for that. You know, they're that simple change on a very personal, very simple level, a level that is often for me easy to feel like, oh, but that's just being PC or whatever, because that gets a lot of guff in our world. But yeah, totally. That's all it would take. You know, that we would need that much less water if people did that. So there's the small scale where the necessity changes when you're not creating as much waste or as much need. And there's the other scale, which is that committed people can often take down big projects like that, especially in their early stages.
And I've been really inspired to be able to work with the Winnemem-Wintu tribe, who are kind of organizing the resistance against raising Shasta. Their reservation and a large portion of their traditional lands were submerged when that dam was built in the 1930s, and they were relocated to a 5-square-mile reservation kind of on the shores of the lake, the reservoir, and now they're fighting the expansion of the dam because the remaining sacred sites that are still above water, including Puberty Rock, where the young children go to for their puberty rituals, and other sites like that, will be submerged by raising the dam. One thing that has been interesting in my interaction with them is that they also have a lot of water quality problems. Their wells are contaminated, their wells are drying up, and so they've become interested in kind of the other stuff that we talk about in the book, and they're looking into installing composting toilets and gray water systems, and they've already done a lot of rainwater catchment to kind of replenish their aquifer. So, I mean, I think that it's an example of how, you know, in terms of a dump, you know, is there a way to promote recycling? Is there a way to mine the landfill for things that are useful? I mean, we're going to eventually be at that point where that's all that's left of our metals, you know, and just to really kind of try to look at all the possibilities. But questions? Design questions? Free consultation. Right now.
Well, zoning.
Yeah.
I know people who built a house and had a compost room for toilets, but it wouldn't pass inspection, so they had to put in a traditional toilet and then change it after people left.
So that's Swedish, right? There's a toilet I remember it's Swedish called the Clivus Molstrom, which is like the name of the inventors, and it is a particular design and breed of composting toilet that is legal. For sure. One solution we have to that / thought we have about that / reason for our nomenclature as the Greywater Gorillas, is that code doesn't change on its own, and code is really restrictive. There are some things that are important to have in various types of code. Plumbing code states that water, a pipe needs to go down a quarter inch for every foot that it goes out so that it will drain. It's like traffic law. Certain things make sense. But there's a lot of other things that are just based on convention and are based on overkill for the sake of public safety that are unnecessary and often harmful, as we said. So a lot of different examples flow through my head of people we know that either bought houses or were adding additions to houses. They did what they had to get the inspector to like it. And then when the inspector was done inspecting and they got final approval, put the other thing back in. Because the thing is that like Albuquerque, Tucson, they have gray water code. They have code that allows gray water, that allows all sorts of things like these projects legally that you can get permits for. But when they decided they needed to go write that code, they went and looked at all the gorilla systems that were out there. They went and said, all right, well, how does this run? They tested that water. They're like, oh, this proves no threat. We're going to write a gray water code. And so like that act of, it's kind of resistance. It's also kind of just doing what you need to do once you've gotten them out of the way, which I can maybe not legally advocate, but is certainly what has happened many times, is exactly the sort of way that code changes. And as soon as that code changes, it becomes a much easier option for a lot of people.
I'm definitely interested in the gray water system and hoping to do something with that. I'm wondering if there are any other tips you could give people for just reducing water usage in general, like bricks in your toilet and low flow shower heads and other really quick, simple things like that too.
Well, the one easiest, biggest intervention that you could start by making is to fix the leaks in your house. Leaks are an amazing 12 to 13% of home water use. And then after that, the toilet is the biggest guzzler. Those leaks, by the way, are mostly faucet leaks and toilets that don't cut off after you flush them. That is, what else use about that? Is that about the same as shower?
Yeah.
It's a little bit less than shower use, but you would save almost as much by fixing your leaks as by never ever taking a shower again.
Do you want to talk about some pipe plumbing-less gray water system too?
Plumbing-less gray water?
I'll talk about that.
It's pretty easy to wash your dishes in a dishpan that sits in the sink, and then take that dishpan, use it to water your plants or to flush your toilet. You can do that without even cutting underneath, and then you've still got the sink drain option if you need it. The bricks in the back of the toilet will often dissolve a little. I don't think bricks are that great. A jug filled with something heavy that sits in the back is more trouble-free.
I was going to say, we flush our toilets with our sink water. We'll take, we have, a bucket for washing our dishes in, and then we have a bucket for dipping to rinse, and we'll take the rinse water and put it in a bucket that has, a little lip, so you can just pour it down the toilet.
Yeah, that's great. You can also have a bucket in your shower with you, too, while you're taking a shower, and it'll catch a lot of stuff.
Which is just another delightful factoid about things you can do to reduce water. 58% of average American home water usage, individual water usage, is outside the home, is watering things, is all sorts of that. So the act of using your dishwasher to water your dishes is actually doing a lot more to take that down than you might think.
And I mean, the other thing about that is just thinking about water that's embodied in products. So both the water that is actually used in manufacturing and power generation, obviously hydroelectricity generation, but also power plants use an incredible amount of water. I think that they're about 10% of the average, actually. And also agriculture is by far the largest user of water. So agriculture in California is 80%. Nationwide, it's pretty close to that. And so obviously supporting local agriculture, supporting farmers who are implementing water conserving or water harvesting strategies is a really great way. Growing your own food is a really great way, because even if you're watering with the hose, I can guarantee you're using less water than a flood irrigation field in the Imperial Valley, where it gets 3 inches of rain a year and it's 120 degrees. Does anyone else have any other ideas? Oh, okay. Question.
Just that, we have a huge garden, and I was wondering if you've seen any good setups for having
The rain barrel's high enough to have a high enough PSI to run a hose because we have to hand water, and it's just like, I mean, it takes to water the whole garden. It takes like 3 hours, two people.
Yeah, no, it's great to build some sort of water tower. So in general, for the flow, you're going to need to keep the same idea of a quarter inch per foot. That will give you a trickle. So say your cistern is right where I'm standing and your vegetable bed is over where you are. That's about 20 feet. So for every – so basically the cistern is going to need to be elevated about 5 inches, and that'll give you kind of a trickle into the garden. If you want pressure, you're going to have to elevate it more. But there's lots of ways that you can actually deliver water right into the root zone of your plants by burying perforated pipes in your beds or having these infiltrator buckets you know, around perennials. And these are all strategies that we talk about and that Annie draws pictures of in Damnation. But you can also build a water tower, you know, out of wood or metal that will elevate a barrel high enough to either irrigate your garden or in the system that we built in Providence yesterday, we were doing a design for the house and we designed a way that they could capture water on an elevated tank and use that to flush their toilet. So that's a pretty simple strategy as well.
If you're harvesting rainwater, just like one of the easiest things, like as you probably know, is like roofs are giant nets for water, and they almost always have gutters. Gutters are so easy to install. Roofs are up high, so it's easy to get that water down to the bucket just by raising your bucket, you know, and then it goes straight. I don't know. Just clarify. Yeah.
My question is just, I'm thinking about how to install some kind of system outside, and I guess I could probably ask folks in the area that probably do it. But how do you deal with when the temperature becomes freezing and
disconnect.
You just disconnect and bring it inside? I mean, you guys probably don't have to deal with it.
It's true, but we're starting to.
Yeah.
Yeah, we really don't have to deal with that in California at all. The systems that we've been doing since we came to the Northeast, we've been trying to take that into account and trying to look at what other people have done and found in the past. We installed one in upstate New York where it gets pretty cold. What they'd had before was a direct gray water application. Just a pipe that ran underground, stuck out of the ground down the hill, and dripped into this area where a bunch of plants grew. A lot of that pipe was buried only 6 inches under the ground, and it had never frozen on them through 2 winters. When we went to give them a wetland system that the water would be processed through after that pipe, we tried to take some precautions, though, by digging out and burying the wetland so that the top of it was level with the ground around it, and it was sunken. And that will provide some protection, although it wasn't below the frost line. What other people have found, what John Todd, who did the living machines, has found, is that the microbial activity that happens in the treatment wetlands keeps things pretty warm during the winter, keeps things moving. Another thing to think about is that most of the gray water coming out of your house is going to be pretty warm. It's from your showers, from your laundry. Even if you usually use cold water for your laundry, you could put it on warm just to keep that from happening. Might not happen anyway. And the kitchen sink water will also be warm. Another thing that happens is a layer of ice will form on the top of the wetland, and then the water level will be sunk below that. There'll be the layer of air that results insulates the lower water from the cold. Oh yeah, if you really want to go all out, it's great to build a greenhouse and keep your wetland in there. Do you guys have anything else about cold weather?
What about it? Well, just that one thing that we do in general is install One thing that we do in general in our systems is install a three-way diversion valve. So you saw that in the drawing where the water, there was still a connection to the sewer that was preserved. And that is useful. We didn't first do it, but it was very useful in a system that we built in Detroit where it gets very cold and they didn't really need the irrigation water in the winter. So they decided to just turn the water back to the sewer during those 4 months where it was kind of bitterly cold and it would really freeze. That's also useful if you are ever going to use bleach or other toxic products, or, you know, dye your hair or wash baby diapers or anything like that, it's important to have a sewer valve so that those pathogens or chemical products are not going to, you know, pollute your backyard.
Some friends of ours in Illinois used their gray water to make a skating rink during the winter, and then as a little pond and wetland and habitat area in the warm times.
I was just wondering in your book if you talk about the connection between like advances in technology like cell phones and computers and their connection with water use. How much water is used?
Although I mean there definitely is. I mean it's an incredible amount of water that is used in the production of electronic devices, and also what is it like 7 pounds of toxic waste per computer, plus the toxics recycling or computer recycling industry is just horrible in terms of its toxic load and also labor practices, where all of our old computers that we throw away every 3 years when a new model comes out are shipped over to Asia, where people work dismantling and salvaging the gold and platinum without any sort of, you know, safety protection whatsoever. I mean, that is true not only of cell phones and computers, but just of almost all of the products that we use are produced in these factories that are often run by hydroelectricity. So, I mean, it is a really central kind of tenet of IMF policy to, when giving a loan to a country, say, hey, you have to build a dam, you have to convert from subsistence to monocrop agriculture, and you have to build these factories, and you have to sell the hydroelectricity produced by this dam at a pittance to this multinational corporation that's coming in to build a factory. So, I mean, and it's the exact same issue as the garbage dump right here in Northampton. It's like, if we can just stop consuming so many products, those all have water and electricity and also just human sweat and blood embedded in them, and it's really, you know, vital that we figure out how to have just a lower impact in general on the planet and take responsibility for our resource use, I think. As I drive my car around the Northeast. Questions, comments, stories? All right, well, we have our books and our posters right over there. Any other last-minute questions that come up, please feel free to ask us. And we're also on the road on tour, so if you feel so inclined, you can make a donation right over there at the poster table to help us get down the road. And thank you very much for coming out. It's great to be back here. I lived here for a year when I was a wee little college student at Hampshire, and it's in 1995, and it's nice to be back in the Pioneer Valley. So thank you.